This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The President's annual State of the Union address usually has a little something for everyone, and this year was no different. When it comes to education, the President focused on the very young.
Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear portions of the President's speech and hear how one state is trying to get a jump on the trend of early education. We'll also learn about a collection of letters from one of America's great 20th century writers, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute juggling hate speech and the First Amendment. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In the first State of the Union address of President Obama's second term, proposals were flying as fast as applause lines, and as expected, education was a major theme. The president called for a huge expansion of programs for the youngest students and prospective students.
You know, study after study shows that the sooner a child begins learning, the better he or she does down the road. But today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do. Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on by boosting graduation rates, reducing teen pregnancy, even reducing violent crime. In states that make it a priority to educate our youngest children, like Georgia or Oklahoma, studies show students grow up more likely to read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families of their own. We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance. Let's also make sure that a high school diploma puts our kids on a path to a good job. Right now, countries like Germany focus on graduating their high school students with the equivalent of a technical degree from one of our community colleges. So those German kids, they're ready for a job when they graduate high school. They've been trained for the jobs that are there. Now at schools like PTEC in Brooklyn, a collaboration between New York Public Schools and City University of New York and IBM, students will graduate with a high school diploma and an associate's degree in computers or engineering. We need to give every American student opportunities like this. And four years ago, we started Race to the Top, a competition that convinced almost every state to develop smarter curricula and higher standards, all for about 1% of what we spend on education each year. Tonight, I'm announcing a new challenge to redesign America's high schools so they better equip graduates for the demands of a high-tech economy. And we'll reward schools that develop new partnerships with colleges and employers and create classes that focus on science, technology, engineering, and math, the skills today's employers are looking for to fill the jobs that are there right now and will be there in the future. Now, even with better high schools, most young people will need some higher education. It's a simple fact. The more education you've got, the more likely you are to have a good job and work your way into the middle class. But today, skyrocketing costs price too many young people out of a higher education or saddle them with unsustainable debt. Through tax credits, grants, and better loans, we've made college more affordable for millions of students and families over the last few years. But taxpayers can't keep on subsidizing higher and higher and higher costs for higher education. Colleges must do their part to keep costs down, and it's our job to make sure that they do. So tonight, I ask Congress to change the Higher Education Act so that affordability and value are included in determining which colleges receive certain types of federal aid. And tomorrow, my administration will release a new college scorecard that parents and students can use to compare schools based on a simple criteria: where you can get the most bang for your educational buck.
And the White House has released that college scorecard. You can find it at whitehouse.gov. There's a link right on the front page. The president also called for a greater emphasis on research and development programs as a stimulator not only of knowledge, but of the economy.
Now, if we want to make the best products, we also have to invest in the best ideas. Every dollar we invested to map the human genome returned $140 to our economy. Every dollar. Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful. Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race. We need to make those investments.
After his speech, the president embarked on a campaign-style road trip to sell his ideas directly to the people. In New York State, advocates for early childhood education recently lobbied at the Capitol in support of both President Obama's and Governor Andrew Cuomo's proposal to expand pre-K programs. The best of our knowledge is Dave Lucas reports.
A big push for pre-K funding in Albany as parents, educators, and law enforcement officials voiced their support for Governor Andrew Cuomo's $25 million proposed budget allocation for pre-K that would establish full-day programs in high-need districts. Albany Police Chief Stephen Krokoff says that early childhood education is a key tactic for crime prevention.
It's already a proven fact. There is a clear nexus between education and poverty and crime.
The advocates stress that full-day pre-K reduces incarceration rates while increasing student outcomes in schools, which in turn results in more success in college and the job market. It also financially boosts households where both parents must work. Raheem Smith is a father of four from Long Island.
So between housing costs on Long Island and the price to put one child in pre-K, and we're talking if they go half a day, at that point, we were paying $860 a month for him to go 3 days a week. If you got one, you're about to be broke. If you got two, you're on the cusp. If you got four, you're going to be looking for a job just to work your regular job. You understand what I'm saying? This is very important. And I'm glad to see the governor behind it. And I came here today to make sure that you know, everybody, that we get out and we rally. And we go ahead and make sure that the legislators, the assembly members, that everybody is behind making sure that we get a full-day pre-K program. Hopefully, they take care of the high-needs districts. But we wanted to see it in every district, ultimately, because we know as parents, everybody needs it for education purposes and for economics.
Last week in Rensselaer County, Dr. Rick Timms, the executive director of the statewide school finance consortium, addressed a crowd gathered at Columbia High School, warning districts and parents to brace for future teacher layoffs. He finds the problem with the pre-K initiative is that there is only $25 million available.
So this grant will be awarded based on factors, includes measures of district and student need, target services to the highest need schools and students, and maximize the number of children served and the quality of their proposal. The problem, therefore, will be most school districts will not be eligible for this grant. The other problem, of course, is that many schools are cutting back in some way on full-day kindergarten, which is not mandated. We believe full-day pre-K is a great idea and full-day K is a great idea, but neither one is mandated and neither one is actually supported by the budget. So what we need is some full funding, and I think these programs would be worthwhile. If they're good enough for some kids, they're good enough for all kids, but the funding must be available. If the state wants them, then they must fund them fully.
Cliff Bird, principal of Abram Lansing Elementary School in Cohoes, attended the Columbia High rally and explains the most important thing for the moment is that the conversation is on the table.
Last year when we were here for this very same program, we were going out cold, trying to get people to understand how important pre-K was. It wasn't in the governor's radar, it wasn't in, except for Shelley Silver, it wasn't on very many other people's radar as well. The seeds must have been planted in the right place because the governor's talking about it now. I think it's a separate issue, what was going on at Columbia High School, because every school district is in fiscal crisis. So pre-K is not going to be important if you don't have a school system for it to feed into.
Bird recognizes that some schools can't even afford kindergarten, let alone pre-K.
This need for pre-K goes well beyond social and economic standards. You just heard, if we have parents that have two working parents, they're not at home. Our school system is set up for kids to be ready when they walk in the door. Our society's not set up for that anymore.
Karen Scharf, executive director of Citizen Action of New York, is calling on legislators to support additional state aid funding beyond what Governor Cuomo proposed to protect full-day kindergarten.
So we want to make sure that in addition to this specific pre-K program, that as we're talking to legislators, that they're conscious of the fact that we've got to deal with school aid as well, because it does no good to have full day, or it does very little good to have a full day pre-K and then have a half day kindergarten.
Advocates fear certain school districts may have to roll kindergarten back to half day sessions to accommodate full day pre-K. Kindergarten is not mandatory in New York State. A handful of districts already have cut kindergarten back to half-day sessions. LowHUD.com reports that 13 districts in the Hudson Valley considered cutting back or eliminating kindergarten as they drew up new spending plans in 2012. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Still to come, one of the great writers of novels of the 20th century was also quite the letter writer. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the Best of Our Knowledge, number 1172. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Any discussion of great 20th century writers will eventually come to Kurt Vonnegut Jr. From the publication of his first story in 1950 to his death in 2007, Vonnegut produced some of the most memorable and influential novels of the century, including Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle, and Breakfast of Champions. He was also a prolific letter writer. This brings us to Dan Wakefield. He has put together an extraordinary collection of personal correspondence called Kurt Vonnegut Letters, which has all the hallmarks of Kurt Vonnegut's fiction. Written over a 60-year period, these letters, the vast majority of them never before published, are funny, moving, and full of the same uncanny wisdom that has endeared his work to readers worldwide. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with Dan Wakefield about how this project began.
I was asked by the Vonnegut estate, because they knew that I had been a friend of his and known him throughout his life from the time we met, and they decided I'd be a good person to do it. So they supplied me with a lot of letters. A lot of letters came from universities and individuals, and it was a big variety, and I had over 1,000 letters to choose from. And it was very hard because his letters are just as entertaining and witty as and wise as his novels and stories.
You go by decades, where you start with the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. That's the way you lay the book out.
Yes, and the first letter in the book is a very powerful letter that he wrote to his family when he had just been released as a prisoner of war, and World War II was over, and he had been a prisoner of war in Dresden, Germany, and was there during the big firebombing. It was one of the last Allied raids of the war. Both the British and U.S. Air Force did this firebombing of Dresden, which nobody thought would be bombed because it was not a military target, but it killed 135,000 people. And Vonnegut, the way he survived, he and the prisoners had been quartered in an underground meat locker. That's how they survived that ordeal, and that was the inspiration for Vonnegut's book, Slaughterhouse-Five. And that was the book that really made him a literary figure around the world.
You write in your introduction, no outside interpreter will ever be able to express this life as truly and as deeply as these letters that Vonnegut wrote to his children, his friends, his publishers, his academic advocates, his critics, and those who sought to ban his work. This really is as close as we'll get to an autobiography then, isn't it?
To an autobiography, yes. Yes, there was a biography. But as far as an autobiography, I think this serves as a wonderful autobiography. And actually, it's the first time that the letters themselves have been published in a book. And, you know, one of the things, there's so many things. I mean, there's wonderful letters to his children, letters to friends he kept up with from high school, to the students he taught at Iowa in the 60s. He's very loyal, very supportive of his fellow writers and his students and certainly his family. And all that comes through in the letters. And also, one of my favorite letters, because it explains a lot about him, was, you know, Slaughterhouse-Five was banned. Sometimes it's still, they still try to ban it, just because of a few words. And after it was first published, I think the first big banning was done by the Drake, North Dakota School Board. They not only banned the book, they burned copies of it in the high school furnace. So Vonnegut wrote a wonderful letter to the head of that school board. If I could just read you one short paragraph from that.
Please do.
He says to the head of the school board, "If you were to bother to read my books, to behave as educated persons would, you would learn that they are not sexy and do not argue in favor of wildness of any kind. They beg that people be kinder and more responsible than they often are. It is true that some of the characters speak coarsely. That's because people speak coarsely in real life. Especially soldiers and hardworking men speak coarsely, and even our most sheltered children know that. And we all know, too, that those words really didn't damage children much. They didn't damage us when we were young. It was evil deeds and lying that hurt us."
It's pretty powerful stuff.
Yes, and throughout his life, he fought against banning books, not only his books, but those of other writers. And, you know, some of our greatest books, people have tried to ban them. You know, The Catcher in the Rye, Huckleberry Finn, even To Kill a Mockingbird, because there's one place in it when a character uses the word hell. And, of course, these attempts are always defeated because it's part of the Constitution of freedom of speech. So a lot of people have to keep learning that.
I was especially moved by some of the early letters that he wrote to his father that go simply, "Dear Pop."
Yes, yes. And in fact, he wrote "Dear Pop" letter the first time he had one of his stories published. And he said that, you know, in those days, those big weekly magazines, which are no more, used to pay writers very well. And he said if he told his dad if he could publish five or six more, he could quit his job as a promotional PR man for General Electric. And he later said that first story he sold was like the Stonehenge of his own literary life. That was the big turning point.
I interviewed him shortly before his death, around the time that A Man Without a Country was released. And yeah. And he said to me that you know, he looks at his work, and he was proud of the fact that his books were still in print.
Yes.
But never quite understood, you know, he'd never won any major literary prize, and felt that the reason for that was because he came from what he referred to as a shabby literary background.
Well, and also, he was never really part of the New York literary scene, even though he lived in New York in his last years, and I think partly because when he started off, he was known or categorized as a science fiction writer, which he didn't like. He felt like that was putting you in a special drawer that wasn't very highly regarded. But the wonderful thing to me is that, as you say, all his books are in print, and he keeps being read, and he keeps being taught in schools and colleges and high schools. A friend of mine who's a professor of English at the University of Massachusetts at Boston said, you know, it's hard to get students now to read Updike and Roth, but they still love Vonnegut.
Again, the name of Dan Wakefield's book is Kurt Vonnegut Letters. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Is it possible to regulate the spread of hate speech while honoring the First Amendment? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. In the United States, it often seems that hate speech is the price we pay for an unwavering commitment to freedom of speech. Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University, lets us in on a debate over ways to eliminate hate speech without doing harm to the First Amendment.
If all mankind minus one were of one opinion, wrote John Stuart Mill, mankind would no more be justified in silencing that one person than he would be justified in silencing mankind. This perspective reflects the exceptional American commitment towards free speech enshrined in the First Amendment and the subject of so much controversy today. In American jurisprudence, although threats can be banned, even hateful ideologies enjoy rights of expression. Think of the Ku Klux Klan's right to burn a cross during a rally or the Nazis' right to march in Skokie, Illinois. Recent academic debate has challenged the American exceptionalist approach, reflecting the view of much of the world which bans the speech that America permits. Mill, however, points to a third way of thinking about hate speech when he emphasizes the obligation of citizens to persuade one another on behalf of equality, even if the law protects the rejection of this value. On my view, government officials, not just citizens, should give voice to the ideal of equality by criticizing hate speech, even if it is protected. For instance, the State Department recently offered an example in a denunciation of the anti-Muslim video Innocence of Muslims of how the state can both protect hate speech and condemn it. Groups such as the homophobic Westboro Baptist Church should be protected in their expression, but there should also be official state criticism of that group's continual hate speech against gays. These acts of democratic persuasion can take the form of revoking state subsidies for hate groups like Westboro, including their favorable nonprofit status. While to speak without fear of punishment is fundamental in democracy, so too is the government's role in speaking in favor of the ideal of equality.
That was Corey Brettschneider of Brown University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.